Hi, everyone. It's your host, Matilda.
And your host, Hadiza.
And your other host, Imam Mam.
And you're listening to the Afrocalypso podcast.
One day you will come to me, gasping through the questions leaking from your nose and mouth, drowning. Your shattered heart a sinking life raft. You will ask me about love, the kind that holds you weightless, sweeps you dizzy with a current that drags you into its center. You will come with your blowfish mouth and ask me why. Sometimes we hurt everything that wants to hold us close. You will ask about the new skin we grow just to protect what is soft and pulsing within us. You will search your mother's face for answers. In your eyes, a flare, a distress signal, a desperate SOS. Baby, I cannot be your life jacket. Your panic will sink us both. But if you are still enough to listen to me, I will teach you how to swim.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to yet another episode of the Afrocalypso podcast. Today, we are joined by Titi Lokpe Shonuga, a writer, a poet, a playwright, and a performer. Hello, Titi. How are you doing?
I am well. How are you all?
We're good. Hey, we're Mama. Good. Hey, Hadiza. How are you guys doing too?
I'm doing okay.
We day.
How's your weeks been going?
Wait, let Hadiza go first.
Why is it me? I can't remember my weeks most of the time.
That is so true. Why?
Okay, I can go. I'll give you time to remember your week, but my week has been good. I'm just prepping for this move, so it's just been like a lot to do, but I mean, in general, it's been good.
Yeah, Imama is moving to Saskatchewan, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Where are you moving from?
I'm moving from Ottawa, Ontario.
Oh wow.
I know, I heard that when I said Saskatchewan, she was like, oh. Nothing happens there.
I mean, things are happening, but
really
type things.
Have you been?
I have been, yeah, but for poultry related stuff. But I also know that there are tons of Nigerians, Africans in general there. So I know that there are pockets of community that you can make. I mean, I live in Edmonton, so I don't know.
I heard there's a Nigerian community there as well.
There is. I mean, there wasn't always. Like, my family has been in Edmonton since we immigrated to Canada. And at that time, really, like, I feel like we knew every other Nigerian family that was here.
That was there.
Things have changed significantly. And then I moved to Nigeria for some time. By the time I came back, I remember the first time I heard people speaking Yoruba, like, in a public place. I was like, a strange feeling, because, like, everything was never like that. It was...
When did you immigrate?
To Canada, 23 years ago. So,
Ooh. Oh, wow.
In 1998, I want to say.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah, it is. I feel like, yeah, you're right. In general, in Canada, I think the Nigerian population is just now developing. Because when you go to places like Houston, like, I mean, the U.S. in general, to be honest, like, they have huge, huge populations that they're even able to divide into their small pockets of, like, Yoruba people, Igbo people.
Like, it's broken in. But I would even say Ontario feels more, like, I follow some bloggers and influencers, Nigerians in Ontario, and I'm always like, you know, they will order Nigerian food from a restaurant, and, you know, like, these are things that are still so foreign here. A Nigerian restaurant or, like, an African restaurant on, like, a Skip the Dishes or whatever it is where they can deliver to your house. No. We're still in this space of, like, oh, I know a lady that cooks, and then I go and pick it up from her house.
That's kind of how... I mean, I think... I know in Ottawa, that's kind of still where we're at. Like, do we have... Really? We have, like, maybe, like, one or two suya spots, but, like, I don't think we actually have a proper Nigerian
You have
restaurant.
One or two suya spots, girl.
As in... that's
I think we have options. Right now,
Oh, damn. Yeah. I thought it was even bad because remember there was this YouTube video we were trying to shoot and literally we only had one option for places to get to get pound or yam. And it was so bad because I guess because they know that they're your only option, they don't care. To be honest, so yeah, it's very interesting.
Like, so we, I mean, we didn't end up getting it because it took so long.
And no, we did.
Like sending us. Wait,
remember we got it at the end.
Food.
Yeah.
Oh, we did. We did, but it just took so long.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, yeah, it took so
long, but we did.
Oh, and Tizzy, we just wanted to ask, like, how has the pandemic been for you as well?
It's been a mixed bag. I would say that life feels sunnier now, and that's also just because like. My moods are so dictated by what's happening outside. The weather really affects me quite deeply. And so Edmonton gets like a really deep freeze. So combining that with the isolation of being inside and not being able to see anybody was extremely hard.
Yeah.
For us, it started in March. I'd say is when like all the lockdowns started to really, really happen. I had taken my son out of daycare because there was some other daycares are just like, you know, kids are always sick and that was a very acceptable thing.
Yeah.
Some other outbreak at his school, hand, foot and mouth, which is a horrible thing. So I'm taking him out because of that and because the school wasn't just doing a very good job of keeping it together when this all was coming up. So I'm like, if they can't control that, I'm not sending this boy back. So we pulled him out of daycare in March of 2020. My husband's work told them to start working from home also that same week. And suddenly the three of us were at home. And all the trying time. To figure out life.
Oh, wow.
I've always been the only one at home. So typically my day looks like they go off to work, they go off to daycare.
Or you have quiet.
Pre-baby, he would just go off to work and I would be at home. And because I'm writing and working, like, it was, the house was my domain. What happened next was that I had a toddler and a husband whose work, he's always in meetings. All of this was happening around me all the time. And so my creative life suffered.
Yeah.
Just because I realized, like, I was telling a friend of mine that I didn't realize how much of my writing process is, like, just sitting and thinking.
Yeah.
I would say that the actual, like, sitting down to write something down is such a small part of that process. And I didn't realize how much solitude and quiet was so important to that process until there were people in my space constantly. And I felt like I couldn't think. And so I wasn't writing because, like, there's no time to be inspired by anything. At first, we just thought, you know, like this thing is happening. We couldn't have imagined how long it was going to be. So it seemed plausible that we could be home, the three of us, and, you know, in a little bit, everybody will go back to their normal lives. But that didn't happen. Like months and months kept passing. I have elderly parents. We couldn't go see them. My sister was in the city as well.
Yeah.
And for a while, they were like our pod family. So because she has two young kids as well. So my son could see his cousins and that.
Yeah.
But then we went to like deep lockdown where it was like, you can't even hang out with your family. So it became quite brutal. And we were also like trying for a second baby. So at some point in the, in the pandemic, I got pregnant. And shortly after that, I had a miscarriage. And so I was home with my husband and my son going through this experience and having
in isolation
alone.
But it also like revealed the, like, I think it's bittersweet because it also revealed the many ways that like intimacy can be formed across distance. So people still, like the people who knew really still showed up for me. Like my friend would drop food at the door, my sister would drop food at the door, or send messages.
Love that.
And things that still made me feel like I was cared for. So I think in many ways the pandemic allowed us to reimagine ways of connecting with people. Much of my relationships are long distance anyway, because I'm floating between here and Nigeria constantly.
Yeah.
But this was a different kind. Like I haven't seen some of my friends in almost 2 years, you know, and so that was hard. And then I got pregnant again.
and you had a baby.
I just had a little girl.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So that's like a success
much of the pandemic,
story.
I was either like recovering or pregnant and just dealing with life. I also, like, in December of 2019, I got like, and people will think I'm strange when I say this, but I got spiritual instruction to like get off social media, right? So I logged off. And the instruction was not complicated. It just was like, log off. I logged off Twitter. I logged off Instagram. I deleted the apps from my phone.
Quick question.
Facebook.
Was that hard?
I thought it would be harder. But once the apps were gone, I was like, oh, okay. I think the key was not just saying, oh, I won't open it. It was logging off, because half the passwords I never remember anyway. And then delete them from your phone. it was hard at first because there's an impulse. You know, you pick up your phone, you check. That was just a part of my life. And so much of my engagement with people who follow my work was posting stuff on Instagram and tweeting and things like that. And so I worried because I'm like, if I'm not there, will people care about my work? Swim had just come out the year before. I'm like, I should be heavily promoting this album, et cetera, et cetera. But whenever I get those kinds of instructions, that's the same instruction that made me quit my engineering job and move to Nigeria. Most of my decision making is
inspiration, it comes from the spiritual place.
That sort of like just listening and doing. Obedience is a big part of my process. And it doesn't always make sense on the outside, but it has never failed me. So when I heard that, and I'd been thinking about it for a while because I was getting like announcement fatigue on Instagram. Everybody was always announcing something. I felt like the content or the people I was following, I hadn't properly curated that list. So I was seeing a lot of just things that were exhausting to my soul. Plus also just the random like things that Instagram will just put in your timeline. I say this to say that I was offline for the whole of, I didn't know there was going to be a pandemic. I logged off in December 2019. There was a pandemic year. There was all this stuff happening in Nigeria with NSARS. And so I felt like I was inside of a bunker. I wasn't online in the way that I normally would have been. I don't know now, like some of it was a saving grace because it allowed me to preserve like a kind of sanity. And it redefined my relationship with social media in a way that even now that I'm back, I'm struggling to find a way to re-immerse and deciding if that is something that is necessary for me. So in summary, the pandemic year was like, it was a mixed bag for me. There was lots of joyful things. And lots of painful things and lots of reflective things.
Yeah.
And I think like everybody else, like I'm forever changed by this experience. I feel like we're still in it, like twice double vaxxed and all that kind of stuff. But like I'm not out there opening my mouth. You know, in
every with this like, Delta Plus thing. With the whole Delta Plus thing, we're still in it, honestly.
So like when the pandemic, like I guess like when we all realized or when you realized that the pandemic was a thing that was here to stay for a while, like as a writer, did you ever consider documenting that process? Like, I mean, like I know you had mentioned that it was a little bit hard for you to write just because of the fact that there were people now in your space that you hadn't really, I guess, planned for. But like, was that ever a thing where you're like, oh, like, you know, let me document this. Let me, I don't know if you journal. I don't know. I guess I assume all writers journal, but I don't know how true that is. But long story short, was that a thing? Like, did you ever consider documenting, like, just the pandemic year in general?
I did. And to be honest, I'm a writer who doesn't journal, so you can go ahead and boo me.
Look at that.
I feel like much of my journaling is in my work, right? So throughout the day, I'm writing things down. I'm, like, chewing on things. I can be chewing on a thought for several weeks before I write it down. And by the time I'm writing something. Like, I don't... And maybe I should, maybe it's something I should introduce into my practice, but I don't journal just for the sake of journaling. I used to when I was younger, but I feel like now everything has to be kind of like a moving meditation because my kids are, you know, they're going to do what kids do. I did consider when I started this year off, because that's what drove my 2020 was I'm taking a year off social media. Let's see what happens. I actually thought to myself, I could really like re-engineer my brain in this time because I feel like what we haven't studied or thought about is like the effects of social media and this hyper awareness and hyper connectedness and what it does to our brains, like in a real tangible way. So I was just thinking, oh, what would happen if for 1 year that impulse was removed? Like, would my brain become another kind of brain? Like, would I write another kind of thing? So I was focused more on that. To be honest, the pandemic was so dark and painful that I wanted to write about anything but.
That
makes sense. And yeah, I can see that.
And even now, like, I just started a term as the Poet Laureate of
Edmonton. Congrats on that as
Congratulations
well.
Congratulations.
Big, big things, honestly.
I wasn't sure how to pronounce that word, so I'm happy you said that.
Okay, Imama, but why are you my spirit animal right now?
You know, I was going to say it, but I was like, I won't have to say it because I can't pronounce that word.
We were going to congratulate you on it at the beginning, but I was just like, I want to hear this word said back at me because I don't. What is that, though?
You're basically like the literary ambassador for the city.
And so that sounds like hefty.
It doesn't have to be. The way that it's set up, it's a 2-year term. And within the contract or the agreement, you have to do 3 events per year that are official, like city events. So they like call you and there's something happening that they want a poet to come and speak at. And I would usually write something for that. But also outside of that, like there's also like a mild expectation that you're just sort of doing things within the city that are arts based and that allow to come together. Of course, that's a little bit more difficult to do within a pandemic year.
Yeah.
But things like workshops, performances, just basically doing your normal life, but like doing it as a representative of the city.
Of the city.
And having that larger platform to promote your work and your arts, but also deeply to promote the city of Edmonton and the story of Edmonton and the people of Edmonton in like through the arts, basically.
Does that shift your creative process a little bit just because now you're representing the city?
I would say that it does not. Okay. because much of my work, and I guess we can get into a larger conversation about how this came to be. In the beginning, when I was writing poems, I would just sit down and be like inspired and write a poem for no particular reason. Mm-hmm. When I decided to have a career as a poet and a writer and all of the things, I quickly realized, and this is through pain and turmoil and tears and sweat, that setup wasn't going to work. So I had to diversify. So I would say that a large portion of how I make my living is through work that isn't necessarily just core creative work. It's like writing for corporations and brands and creating work that is like a service that is specifically for those kinds of pockets.
Okay.
So I'm kind of accustomed to being of two minds. So the mind that is like, I'm writing an album and the album is for me, or I'm doing open, I'm doing a show and that show is for me and for my heart. And then there's the work that is like, Google has come and said, we want to do XYZ. Okay,
yeah.
You have to write for that. It's a balance that I've had to strike.
Yeah.
That doesn't
take
away from my other work. In fact, it frees me up because if I'm able to earn that way, then I can create work that I love just because, without the pressure of it doing anything in particular.
Yeah. Oh, so you just answered the question I was going to ask, because I was just going to be like, isn't that draining? But you've just mentioned that it's actually able to free you to do your other work.
Yeah, it frees me mentally to do my other work because, there isn't the pressure that Swim is going to be, you know, like a chart topping album or whatever. There's no pressure on Swim to pay my mortgage. Like those things don't come to mind when I'm creating my own work. I will say that there is, where it becomes dicey is that sometimes, and I would say I'm in a particular season where there's more of that corporate work that I have to do than my ability to write my own. So there's always the balance. So I'm doing more of work for other people than I am in this moment, like creating my own work. And that gets even dicier when you have kids. So like I have a toddler and a 2-month-old. And so there's no time already. And then if the time that exists is for other people, I really, really now, in more ways than ever before, have to be like, I'm just writing because I'm writing. I want to go back to my 20s and all the hours I spent either sleeping or faffing, I want them back.
Wow. You know, like, I want them still back. Sleeping all out this, here.
Just faffing about doing nothing, just there, you know? Like, I want those hours back because I would, if I get like an hour in which I'm just sitting and writing, it feels like something has happened. I always tell myself, it feels like I've lost my keys whenever I leave the house without any child. I'm just like, did I forget something? Like,
damn.
Yeah.
It's crazy because I have those sleeping moments, but I still don't think that there's enough of that.
Well, my children, your day is filled with stuff. That's why.
I know, but like, imagine adding kids to that, because that's what she's talking about. That sounds crazy.
But I also think, like, I'm not saying that because I'm like a hustle and, you know, those people that like wake up and hustle, wake up at 5 a.m. I prioritize rest, and this life is for alafia. Like, it's for resting.
They said the rich wake up at 5 a.m.
That's not true.
I'm like, that's their business.
The rich hire people to wake up at 5 a.m.
Exactly.
Like, I think it's just like, I think that we are definitely in a culture, and this is what I was saying about this Instagram like announcement fatigue that I was having too. It was like, I was getting the impression that everybody else except me in the world was grinding, you know, like just grinding. And I'm just like, but I didn't come to this life to just grind.
It's
Beyoncé has the same 24 hours as you, Twitter.
Honestly.
But Beyoncé walks and then rests for a couple of years.
And a team. Exactly. You know.
Yeah. And I find that very interesting. Like, I would love to delve into your creative process, because the way that you talked about direction and like just listening to that voice that tells you is really interesting. But I think we should throw it back to the genesis of this, because you are a poet now, but you studied engineering, and I find that very, very interesting.
Relatable.
Yeah, relatable, because okay, this is something we didn't share with you, Titi, but all three of us on this podcast studied engineering as well. So we're fellow sisters.
What kind of engineering did you guys as in,
I did mechanical.
I did architectural engineering.
Yeah, and I did biomedical and mechanical engineering.
Okay, all right.
So sisters in the struggle. Yeah, so I really
are you all practicing.
I think Hadiza is.
I'm so the closest for me, I'm on my way to, yeah, like after I'm doing an internship now, but on my, like after this, I hope it's an engineering job. But interestingly, I love the fact that we're speaking to you, because like I also want to go into more creative space. So I'm so interested or curious to know how you made that transition, because it seems like it's a big thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So if it's possible to walk us through the process, like even throwing it back to like when you were younger, because I'm pretty sure the love for writing and stuff like that started from when you were younger. So if you could please walk us through this process, because we would love to hear it.
Why you say like that? I was just like, if you could please.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people will say, oh, when they were a child, they had a dream of being an artist or an actor or... But I never, and I have to be full disclosure, I never dreamed of being an artist or a writer or a storyteller in any way, because in the upbringing that I had, those options were never presented to me as something that was possible. So it didn't even occur to me to think of it. I know, like, I grew up in a house with three older sisters, so four of us, four girls. And my parents were very, very particular about exposing us to all kinds of things. So my dad loved classical music and arts and books. And so we were four girls in a house. We were very sheltered and protected, which meant that we weren't, like, we didn't go anywhere. So we just stayed home and read books. And made up stories and games. And like, I feel like I'm always saying, my husband and I joke now, whenever my son says, or like acts like he's bored, I'm like, I was bored my whole childhood. So he used his creative energy.
So you'll be all right. Just,
you know, so there was a lot of that. There were four of us, so we had company, but we did a lot of reading and just like solitary time. My dad would take us to Musan Center. I don't know if you know Musan Center in Nigeria.
Oh, and Mama used to, we were in choir in our school, so we used to perform. There.
Like, we used to go there as kids, even long before we understood what was happening on the stage. I remember the AC was always so cold. That's the only thing I remember about Musan. We had to wear sweaters to go there because we were always
yeah.
And, you know, we would sit there and fall asleep or wake up. And, you know, there was some kind of immersive thing that was happening, even though I didn't recognize it. I loved the arts. My uncle was really, really involved in, like, theater arts. And so I had been exposed. But my father was an engineer and my uncles were engineers. And so it was never presented to me that art was a thing that people did in their lives as a real thing. So I'd known since I was young that I was going to do something that was like engineering or like very, very serious, quote unquote. What I actually wanted to be was an architect, but my father was a civil engineer. And I remember us having a conversation in which he kind of explained how civil engineering could be the best of both worlds. For him, it felt like engineering had more core science backing. So he was like, would you consider that?
Yeah.
I remember my dad has oscillated between wanting me to be an engineer and also wanting me to not be an engineer. There was all these conversations around like civil and like you're in the outdoors, you're traveling to like remote areas sometimes. There's a lot of that. But I stuck to it. Like, we moved to Canada. We immigrated to Canada. I was 13 years old at the time. And the immigrant story, we all know it's like you study hard and you do your work.
Yeah.
So to come back and say I want to be an artist was like a joke. Like, you couldn't, it wasn't something that occurred to me.
Makes sense.
So I went to U of A and hustled through what was a really challenging engineering program. Challenging academically, but also challenging in the ways that like there were very few, more than obviously in my father's
time,
but very few women and also very, even fewer black women.
I was just going to say or ask, like, because, okay, even in our time when we went to school in engineering, we experienced that. But you went to school back when, like, you know,
in the Stone Age.
There were no blacks.
No, like, but for real though, you complained about, like, not having enough, like, Nigerians in Alberta. And then also, Canada probably hadn't started pushing out, like, oh, we need more women in engineering and all those kind of initiatives they have now. So, like, yeah, I can't imagine how that must have been like for you, like being.
Yeah, I think they had a bit, and in that, like, I knew that the women that were in the faculty were like respected, and they loved the fact that more women were coming into the field. So I didn't feel shut off in that way. But to find community, I had to go to other parts of campus, which is what led me to that. So there were Nigerians, like international students, but also like non-international students who were there doing all kinds. They were in the business faculty, they were in the arts, all that kind of stuff. And the places that we congregated were like at the BSA, the Black Students Association, formerly known as SASH, the Students of African and Caribbean Heritage. And we put on, like, you know, how you do fashion shows and food fairs.
Not much has changed. Exactly. I'll tell you that.
And so it was in those circles that I was able to kind of explore an alternate life. So I would go to my engineering faculty, do my work, cry, and then go hang out.
Why do we all have the same experience?
Same story when you're in the same life.
You know, it's extremely brutal. Yeah, and go hang out with my friends in my free time. It was in those spaces. It was at a SASH meeting that I, like, Black History Month was coming up, and I wrote, like, I had been writing at this point. Like, I had a high school teacher who had encouraged my writing. And so I was writing poems, but it was
actually a quick question. You said high school. Mm-hmm. Do you mean like in Canada or in Nigeria?
In Canada. So I started in Canada in grade 8.
Okay.
So I did 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, university, etc. So it, like, in grade 10, I had an English teacher who really, like, took to the work that I was writing and really encouraged me to keep writing. And so whenever we had, like, SASH events, I would read a poem that I'd written and they would hype me. And, you know, there was a Black History Month where I'd written this poem, which in retrospect, like, that poem should be thrown by
somewhere. It's growth.
But I was so proud of it. And I was so proud of it because they loved it so much that the U of A used to have these, like, glass display things. Where they would, whatever the month was, they would display things from that month. So Black History Month, they would do like a whole Black History Month, like, display in this clear glass thing. And they had my poem in there with other Black History Month related things. And I was just like, you know, like, in my mind, I had done something. And I think at the time I wasn't even at the university yet. I think I was still in high school. So I would go to the, because my sister was president at the time, I would go to their meetings. And so anyways, I had this alternate life. That allowed me to explore the arts as a hobby. I graduated. Mm-hmm. I started working immediately. I was even in the co-op program, so I was already working before I graduated.
Holla.
Nice.
Which was great, because once I graduated, I had a job.
Not holla.
Nice.
Because I didn't. Sorry, I didn't. What's up? I was related to... Yeah, sorry.
I should have taken a year off or something. I should have done... If I had taken that year off, I probably would have...
Started already... immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. But I started working. I started working on a pretty major construction project here in Edmonton, the 23rd Avenue Interchange. It's like this massive interchange. And already, like, I knew that it was exciting and fun. I was outside in the field with, like, the boys and having to really think on my feet. There was a lot of pressure. Like, I was just graduated, and sometimes I'd be alone on site having to make decisions about some things. And I'm just like, if this one goes and collapses now,
it's on my head.
You know, those sorts of things. In fact, there's still some errors that I made in that time. Whenever I drive past the interchange, I'm like, oh yeah, that was like a day where I was doing nonsense, and that thing is now nonsense too. But I was writing on the side and going to workshops and traveling for the weekend to go perform places. And my bosses knew. They would sometimes even come to my poetry shows. Aww. I was so deeply supported that, like, I've never, like, I feel extremely privileged and lucky to have had that kind of support. Like, I started a poetry night downtown Edmonton. The CEO of my company would come drink a beer and listen to poetry and then see me on Wednesday morning, like nothing happened. Like,
yeah.
So I was really supported in that way, which allowed me to explore. I took a leave of absence. I went to South Africa for a residency for 2 months, 3 months. Extended it, stayed there even after the residency was done. Just writing, living as an artist. And I feel like that's where I got the first taste that like there were people in the world that were doing this for real.
For a living, yeah.
For a living. And so once that seed was planted, it was like a seed that started to bloom in my chest, quite literally, and like consumed me. I couldn't stop thinking about
like, mad, and your employer enabled this.
I know, you know what I mean? Like, what are you doing? There's so little time. You're in your 20s. You are never going to be this unencumbered. You're never going to be this single Pringle. You're never going to be this, like, financially unhinged to anything. Like, every penny I was making was just for me. You know, that sort of thing. And so I just made a decision in the same impulsive way to leave my job. And I remember telling my boss, I had just gotten my PNG at the time. They had moved me into a nice window office.
You got that far.
They were setting me up.
Yeah.
You know, to do
But can I say that that's wise, though, to get your PNG first before you
before
left?
Before like, leaving. Just in case, like, right, you can come back and you're licensed.
Yes.
I feel like it's more...
That PNG process is based on your experience, like what you've done.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, I got it. And then... I broke the news first to my immediate supervisor, and I remember I cried. I just sat down and I started to weep. And as soon as I started crying, he was like, I know why you're here. And that made me cry.
Wait, I have a question. Why did you cry? Like, did you cry because you were going to miss it, or because like you were happy about where you were going?
I was crying because I knew in my soul that I was making a decision that was going to change the entire course of my life. So it was a mix of euphoria and terror. And just like a knowing, I was overwhelmed. Like, you know, when you say the words out loud, like you can't stuff it back in your mouth.
Yeah.
That something, some shift was happening in my universe.
Yeah.
And the words that I was speaking were causing that. And I was overwhelmed. I just started crying. And he was like, I know why you're here. And he said, like, I'd be lying if I said I didn't know this day was coming.
He said, we've been waiting for you.
He was like, we've seen you. We've seen how you've been growing. By this time, like, I had, like, things had happened. I had, you know, gone to perform for Chinua Achebe. I had met Maya Angelou. I had, like, things had happened.
Oh, you met Maya?
I did.
Oh, no. Oh, Miss Maya, please. Sorry.
Miss Maya to you,
Miss
Maya,
yes.
Yeah, so things had happened. So the people in my life kind of were like, ah, this poetry thing, like, things are happening. But I don't think anybody really thought, like, there were too many examples of people that had done it successfully, but
yes.
So I told him, and then the news spread, and they basically just let me know, like, you have our, they did everything to support me, everything. They gave me like my I was there for 5 years, my 5 year badge. They did a whole ceremony. They made sure that I knew that if I needed to come back, the doors were open.
Please refer me. If you can,
I was about to say, which company, please? You guys, can you share companies?
Perhaps if you can refer me, it would be nice.
Can we please focus?
No, I can't do it. That's so supportive. A lot of companies will
even now,
burn
I still
that
talk
bridge.
To all of them.
Wow.
I know. And I feel like, even though they had supported me, I was like, ah, what if I say this thing? And then these people are like, are you crazy? We just got you your PNG and now just bouncing. But they were the complete opposite. Even today, when my, you know, like when my poet laureate announcement came, they sent, my CEO sent me an email. My Tony, my boss at the time, sent me an email as well. They're always checking in on me. They follow me on Twitter and Instagram. Like, they are with me.
God bless their hearts.
Oh, I love that. Oh, honestly, like, so a supporting nice. Community, like, does a lot to, like, you know, just boost you, like, in anywhere in life, really.
Look, one of the C-level executives at that company, who is now retired from the company, follows me on Facebook and still constantly checks on me.
Wow.
Like, I was loved on, like, I was cared for at that place. And that, I don't take that for granted at all.
No, you shouldn't.
Because those years allowed me, like, I was earning an engineering salary, but was able to do all the things I need. So my first book was self-published because I'm like, I could just publish
it. You had the money.
Pay for it.
You know? And I don't regret those years at all. And I've now started to see how engineering and the arts are both, like, such an important part of who I am. But yeah, I quit my job, and then I'm like, let me heighten difficulty and move to Nigeria since my madness has not ended.
If you could also please delve into how you told your Nigerian parents, because how?
So I did it first. And all of this stuff I'm saying, I'm not saying because I'm saying this is a formula that you should follow. In fact, in retrospect, I don't have the guts to do it again the way that I did, which is why the 20s are such a magical time where you are filled with confidence and also like confusion sometimes, but also like everything just feels so possible. So I did it first and then I told my parents. I will also say that like I had paid my way through school. So I was doing my co-op job and I paid my own tuition with my co-op job money.
Yeah.
And so in a way I earned that degree for myself, for my parents, but for me.
Yes.
So the only person's money I was wasting by quitting was my own. So there was
that's
a sense
the difference.
In which
I had
owned that process from start to finish and could therefore say, I know what the risks are. I know what the expenses were. And this is a choice that I'm making. Of course, I didn't speak this boldly and courageously to my parents. I also cried again. But I just said, yeah, at this point, I think everybody in my life was, you know, the smoke was smelling. Like they all understood.
They all knew.
They all knew it was coming. It was just a matter of time.
And my parents, strangely, maybe it was the Holy Spirit, strangely, they were not like extremely opposed to it. Like they were just like, okay, and now what's your plan?
Yes.
There was no screaming or shouting. It wasn't big drama. They were just like, all right, let's see what happens, you know? Yeah, so I moved to Nigeria. And at the time, I was like, oh, I'm just taking 6 months to just figure things out. Even though in my soul, I just knew that 6 months was going to extend. So I thought to myself, if in 6 months you're broke, everything has scattered, just go
you
back
can
to your
come
work
back.
Quietly.
Yes.
And never talk about this thing again. But 6 months turned into 1 year, into five. And it's been almost 10 years I've been at this.
Wow.
Sorry,
how old were you? I know you mentioned you were in your 20s, but how old were you then?
Maybe 10 years ago, I was...
No, I don't want to put it in thing, because some people are like weird about talking about their age.
I've earned every year of this 36 years. I'm turning 36 on August.
Oh, so you were 26.
15th.
Okay.
So I was like 26-ish.
Okay, so I have 2 years to get my shit together. Okay, got it.
Wait,
it's bold.
What inspired that move to the interest? Because as far as I know, like just hearing your story, it sounds like
said that's the biggest risk.
No, wait. Because it's like you had kind of moved here like when you were like year eight. And like, you know, you stayed here, you did high school, you did university. So it's like, what inspired that move back to Nigeria, I guess? What were you looking for before you went there?
Okay. All right. So we moved to Canada when I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go back to Nigeria again until I was 23.
Oh, wow.
But once I went back at 23, it was for like my grandfather's funeral or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I went with my parents. So that was one experience. And then like another Christmas came and I went to Nigeria by myself with my cousins and had another experience. You know, when you travel to Nigeria by yourself for the first time, that's when you know that you are like, you're about to start adulting.
Yes.
So the experience was not just going to uncle and auntie's houses. It was like going to nightclubs and bars. It was going to Bogobiri to go watch poultry open mics and watch people perform. It was going to Freedom Park. Like I was starting to see this really beautiful community of young Nigerians that were moving back home, doing incredible things. Even the ones that hadn't left or gone anywhere that were at home building like from scratch. And this was happening across industries, right? And the arts was bubbling, like something was happening. I'd performed some of my poetry in Nigeria and people had responded. And I was nervous because I just thought they may not be able to relate to the things I'm talking about, but they loved it and had received me warmly. And I wanted to explore, because I had done lots of stuff in the Edmonton community. So I had started this open mic that ran every Tuesday for 10 years. I had performed and competed at national competitions in Canada. So like the CFSW, which is the Canadian Festival of Spoken Word, competing against poets from across the country. So I felt like there was an exploration that I had done here that I wanted to see what was possible to do in Nigeria. I wanted to experience Nigeria as an adult woman without supervision. And I just needed a break I needed to shift completely from the life that I was living. Full disclosure, before this, I had dated somebody.
Oh no, there was it a wasn't boy. Oh no, man. There's always man. There's always man.
No. At the time when I moved back, we were not together anymore. But in the time when I had started going back to Nigeria several times a year, I was in this relationship, and that relationship allowed me to see Nigeria in new ways as well. Go to places I wouldn't normally go, make friends, that sort of thing. So I had experience, like I just felt like, you know, if there's ever a time that I'm going to live in Nigeria for, it was always going to be finite, or I thought. It just felt like a good time. Since I was already blowing up my life, it was like, cuckoo, blow.
Let's just like, add this one.
Let's just finish it.
Blowing it up. So I quit my job in May. By June-ish, I had moved to Lagos. I was living with my uncle, my mom's first cousin. And he lived in a really central area in Ikoyi. Central to the things I was trying to do. So Bogobiri, I could walk there. all of the things I needed to do in VI. Like, it was, everything was very, very, very close. And so I was able to explore Lagos, which, with not very much. Like, I didn't go to, I had savings that I had kept and said, okay, I'm doing this, this stupid thing. For six months, if I don't make another penny, I can, you know, I have some savings that I'm
going to make this thing work with. Shout out to engineering.
Exactly. Shout out to engineering. And then let's see what I can do to start making a bit of money myself, which took a very long time, I must say. And then I just started exploring Lagos and living my best. And I think that's when things actually really took off for me in very real ways.
Wow.
So, like, my introduction to you was, like, in Giddy Up. Was this also the time that you did Giddy Up?
Yes. So I moved to Lagos in that June. And I think later on that month, I had been invited to perform at an event. I don't know if you know Bem Yoda. He's an incredible artist, like a musician in Nigeria. Well, he's not in Nigeria right now, but he's Nigerian. And he was doing an event, Bem Yoda and Friends. And I had been invited to be one of the and friends. So to come and perform a poem. And so I went to perform. By this time, my album Mother Tongue had been out. So people, some people, they had played it on the radio. Like, people kind of, a few people... a small cult following knew my work, or at least knew me from like the Bugubiri crowd. So that's how I got sort of invited to that performance. So I did the performance, but while I was performing, or after, I met Jade Sola Oshiberu, who's the director, writer, creative mind behind Giddy Up and so many other incredible projects, like film projects out of Nigeria. And my other friend, Lala Kindoji, who's like a, she's a producer, she's a theater artist, she's also like a casting director as well. Anyway, so they approached me and said, have you ever thought about acting? And I'm like, no.
No.
But I can try. And so they were like, just come to this audition. We'll send you an email. They were very like coded. Like, they didn't say a whole lot. Then I went home and just was like, okay, well, let's see what happens. And I get this email saying, such and such day, come for an audition for a show called Giddy Up. And like, I got goosebumps because just before I moved to Lagos, I had watched it, like binge watched.
Yeah, season one was already out. Yeah.
On YouTube. And I thought, oh my God, like, it was part of that thing of like, I knew things were happening in Nigeria because I had never seen a show like that before.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you go from watching Nolly Lolly to seeing like,
film projects in Nigeria that
had like a sexy look and feel, I'm like, ah, like, you know, things I'd watched the show and loved it. So when I saw the script and it said Giddy Up on there, I said, ah, I'm like, oh, this is really cool. So at first I thought like it was a new character.
Yeah.
And then I realized that I was auditioning for Eki, which already had an existing Orica goddess who like killed that role. So I was auditioning for that role. So I was just like, okay. So a bit of panic set in because I was like, what have I agreed to? And what do I think I'm doing? But I was also in that, my say yes to the universe year of like, I'm in Nigeria. Any artistic thing that comes my way, just be doing. Like, let's just see what's going to happen. And so I went for the audition. I arrived that day and it was full of people. And these people are serious acting people for real. And that part of the audition, actually, they had done a pre-audition, which was like an open call.
Oh, wow.
And so people from the open call were now at their second audition.
This was your first. The
open call, and they had invited me for this closed audition. So I think because maybe from the first open call, they hadn't really seen Eki yet. And so they were like, let's just throw this girl in there and see what happens. So there are people there auditioning for Eki who had already auditioned before.
Yeah.
And here I come. I'm in the room. I'm looking around. I'm just like, okay. What I had done before that was like, with poetry, I'd been memorizing like poems for years at this point. And so I was confident that if for nothing else, I will remember the lines and I'll be able to say them. Acting, I don't know anything about. I'm just going to act like myself to the best of my ability. Eki felt like a very familiar character. She felt like me. Yeah. And she felt like somebody I could recognize. Like, I know her. You know, so it didn't feel like much of a reach. So I go to the audition. I'm just there. People are prepping. They're doing their stuff. I'm just looking like, okay, like, what am I supposed to be doing in this time? And, you know, Lagos, like, hours of just waiting and waiting. I finally get called up. And I read the part. And the reading is, like, Jade, Lala, and I think maybe two other people were at a desk. Like, real serious stuff. And you're just kind of standing in front of them. There's also cameras behind them. So they're filming. I wonder where that audition tape is. I'd probably cry my eyes out.
But you're used to performing. Yeah.
So I wasn't, like... That's the thing. Like, this thing about, like, every gift that you have, every tool in your toolbox will always count for something. And I say, whenever I'm feeling like kind of down or whatever, I'm always telling myself, the years of nothing will count for something.
For
I read
something.
This somewhere. So it's like every book you've read, every skill you have acquired, every piece of knowledge that you have will come together in some unknown way in the near future to like move you to your next level. And so I was like, okay, this is the time in which I see where my confidence with being in front of people, small or big audiences, my ability to memorize and know my lines have now come to aid me such that those things are muscle memory. The only thing I need to worry about now is being like convincing and believable. I don't know that it was a great audition. I'm not saying all this because I like killed the audition. I don't know. I know I went and I read the part. And when I finished, they started to applaud. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. They're like, okay, go downstairs. We'll call you back up for part two. I go back downstairs. I'm still thinking, I mean, they seemed happy, but they're, look at all these people here, beautiful people with great acting chops. The second part of the audition was to audition alongside Somkele and to see what kind of chemistry that we had.
Yeah.
So Somkele played Yvonne on the show. And so I come upstairs again, and Somkele is one of my best friends now. Simply because, like, I have lifelong friends.
From the show. From
that Giddy Up experience. Mm-hmm. And this was the marker of the friendship that Somkele and I were going to have, because I came upstairs and immediately, like, okay, you guys read together. We started to, like, act out a scene. It felt like I had known her my entire life. I felt so comfortable and, like, so we did the audition together, and everybody stood up and started clapping because it felt, and they would later say, like, they had been auditioning and auditioning, they just couldn't feel something that felt real or like a genuine connection. And yeah. I feel like it's because me and this person were going to be friends anyway. And so she's like locked into my life now. She can't go anywhere. but yeah, we had I think what was for me like a really magical audition process. And so I left not even knowing that I'd gotten the part. I went home. I didn't hear anything from anybody again. I was just like, okay, whatever. And then, then I got the call that I had gotten the part, and it was time to go to, we went to Actors Boot Camp. I lost a bit of weight as well. Not that it was like a requirement. Eki's character was this, you know, kind of petite, and I've never been petite in my life. But so there's just like all of this work that needed to happen beforehand. And I realized like actors are real, like it's a real thing. So when people say, well, are you doing any more acting? Are you an actor? I just say no, because I haven't dedicated enough time to grooming that gift. And I have such respect for the thing that they do that I can't just do it anyhow. But Giddy Up was a beautiful, like that I would say is what cemented my time in Lagos. Now I had purpose. I was there shooting a show.
For a reason.
And the show became a bridge into my actual work, and it, that I would say is how my audience started to grow, and it changed my life, really, that show.
It changed our lives too, I can't lie. Because I think that was one of the first YouTube shows out of Nigeria, like one of these like modern shows.
That and like MTV Sugar, I think.
Oh yeah, Sugar as well was there.
They came out around the same time. Yeah.
That really cemented like these YouTube shows that exist right now. And
oh, absolutely.
It was amazing. I feel like everything in your life, it's from, at least, I'm not sure if it's because you're a really good narrator already, or it just seems like everything in your life is organic. And I think at the beginning you talked about, like, you know, listening to, like, there's always been a voice that tells you, like, you know, do this thing, and you listen to that. Mm. How can we get that too? And like, what do you think that is, and how do you think that was built, and where do you think it comes from? Because I really want to, I would love to have it.
they're a mixture of things, right? So I think because I write, I spend a lot of time inside of my head. and a lot of time like turning over my thoughts and feelings and examining them and thinking, is this a real thing? Is this not a real thing? Is this legitimate? Is this not? Like all of that. And this is a good and a bad thing, because it affects me negatively in my life as well, in that like I feel like I'm always... I can think, you know,
overthinking sometimes.
When someone says, if there's an Olympic event, and that person's like,
overthinking, I saw that.
I can think from morning to night, you know, like I laugh because I'm like, this is so me. So there's that element of in that I feel like I'm hyper aware about what I'm feeling and thinking and observing of the world, which makes me, in some ways, I feel like I know a thing before I know a thing. Like, I feel like I'm highly intuitive as a person. But I also have a spiritual life that guides me as well. I'm a Christian, full disclosure.
Yeah.
And a lot of my prayer life, my spiritual life informs my work as well. And it does so in ways that I feel like, and I think this applies for anyone really, no matter what you classify yourself as. Our time on earth is so finite and so sometimes so fragile and short. And I think that I believe that all of us have something to offer. And our entire time here is spent trying to sort of discover that thing and to give it back into the world. And that has been my central, like, understanding of my life, is that I'm here to be of service in some way. Yeah. And that that gift, that calling is given to me by God, by my creator, by a force that is greater than me. And therefore, that force knows what I'm supposed to be doing next. I trust in my destiny. Like, I trust my dreams. I trust that there is something I'm here to do. And my job is actually to, like, remove all of the clutter and noise that does not allow me to move in the right direction. I think intuition is the way that the spirit speaks to us. You know a thing before you know a thing. And I say that to say that, like, when you walk into a room, sometimes there are vibes. Like, you know, okay, that thing, like, I don't want to be here right now, or I should go with this. You know, like, these sorts of feelings that you get. So I feel like if you spend time kind of grooming and massaging that muscle, it becomes a part of who you are. And if you spend time listening as well to hear what the next thing is, you know it when it comes. This is not to say that my journey hasn't been easy. I've had some really dark times, sometimes in which I was like, you have now messed up the whole, the whole thing. You know, times in which I'm unsure about what I'm feeling or thinking, times in which, like, there's been so many, like, my first few years in Nigeria, I was perform, like, you'd be performing somewhere, their band is playing, people have turned their backs to you. Like, I performed on events where the entire audience had their back to me.
Oh my gosh. I'm actually just like crying.
Honestly.
So there's been those moments in which I didn't trust my intuition. I didn't trust any of the things that were happening. But I've just found that, like, it has really has not failed me. Like, if I really look back on it, like, all of it has been onto something, even the times that didn't make sense. So it's a mixture of poetry and storytelling and writing kind of invites into itself this self-reflection that makes your own inner voice clear. And also, for me, it's believing in a higher power. It's believing in more, in believing that I'm connected to, like, a universal energy, and I'm connected to other human beings on this earth trying to fulfill their destiny, trying to fulfill their purpose. And as long as I'm in service of that, there's no wrong turn. Like, you turn in a wrong turn and you still, like, it still guides you back to where you're supposed to be. So I'm always telling myself that I'm not powerful enough to destroy my life. Like, you're not powerful enough to scatter the whole thing. So you, like, it's like Edmonton, I always tell my husband, Edmonton's built on a grid. So you make, you know, a couple of left turns and you're back where you started. So destiny fulfillment feels a lot like that. Like, you can make some left turns, but always, like, I trust, or I try to trust, that I'm going to still be headed in the right direction.
Regardless. Yeah.
I was going to say, I just know that I'm going to listen back to this episode, like, multiple times. Oh, like, there's so many gems dropped. Like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's very interesting. No, I was really just reflecting on what you had said, because the truth is, in some way, a little way, I feel like I shared the same emotion, because, of course, like, there's been times where, you know, you mentioned how there's some skills that you have now that, like, they seem really useless, and they come together at some point, like, that you're like, this doesn't make sense. But for whatever reasons, maybe it's the lack of reflection, I still find myself anxious about the next steps and everything, because it just so much is happening, and this fear of failure and stuff still, like, drives most of the stuff I do. Whereas it seems
what are you dreaming about right now? Like, what is it that you want to do? What is your dream?
That's kind of hard.
Oof, I feel like this just became a therapy session.
But I think even another thing is, I even fear to dream, because I feel like my dreams are so outside my reality currently that it's scary. And what I have right now, I at least understand that it feels like where I dream isn't even a possibility. So when I hear you just moving through life, almost naturally letting the next thing happen, it's very interesting. Because, for example, engineering, I enjoyed engineering. It's not that I didn't. I enjoyed the challenge. But I think there were multiple points in engineering that showed me that this wasn't my natural skill, where I saw it with other people. And I saw things like, for example, talking or reading and stuff like that. I had been wanted to be a journalist at some point, but I didn't listen to that, because that wasn't the path of, you know, in my head. Yeah, it didn't make sense yet. Yeah. I hadn't seen people go before me and make that possible. It's not within my peripheral. Like, I haven't seen it happen. So the dreams that I have, I feel like I don't even understand it. So I don't even dream about it. Mm. So it's very interesting to see someone that has done that. And I respect it. And as Imama said, I'm going to go back and listen.
Yeah, I know. I'm definitely going to go back and listen. Like, I think your story is very interesting. I think it's also one full of grace. Like, I think, like, grace. Yeah. And, like, also just, like, I don't know. There's just, like, so many, like, points in your story that I'm like, wow. Just, like, taking it all in. Like, wow, this is just such, like Machida said, like, just, like, moving through life. Like, as opposed to, like, just letting life move through you.
I feel like a lot exactly.
Of people just let life move through them. But it's, like, I know you that it sounds actually took magical, that effort.
Right? So please don't romanticize this.
Exactly. Like, I want to be clear in that, like, in retrospect is when all of it
comes together.
That makes right? sense.
It's in retrospect that in the telling of the story that I'm like, oh, wow, this happened and that happened. But inside of it is hard. Like, inside of it is lonely and painful at times. Inside of it is like, you have all these things in your mind that you cannot explain to other people. In my family, I'm the fourth, so I'm the last born. I have three older sisters. One's a pharmacist, one's an accountant. Like, one works in the banking industry.
The original Nigerian professions. Yes.
They have serious jobs.
Serious people. And for a long time, I was always the strange one that was living in Nigeria. What are you doing? They couldn't really understand, you know. And before I started to really, really hone in on my skill and have the confidence to even call it a service that I provide that I can charge for, I was doing a lot of shows for free. I was looking at my savings account just going down, you know, and feeling like I had gotten this education and I was squandering my life. I'm saying this to say that it hasn't always been clear. I have moments that where it's loose, I'm lucid and I'm like, okay, I'm doing it. It's making sense. And I would, in this work, there's also like, big things happen and I'm like, okay, this is the moment. I performed at the inauguration of the president, you know? My life was supposed to, like, something
did you?
Happen. Yes.
Oh, sorry, wait.
You know, like, things were supposed to happen and that day ended up being one of the hardest days. Like, I cried that day because it was just chaos. As Nigeria, there was a chaos. And nothing really came out of that in my career that I can say was a tangible thing. So there's always this kind of rocking back and forth in which you're like, it's going, it's not going.
You feel like you're at the cusp of something and then, like, you know.
Yes, but what keeps me moving is that, like, I'm always saying I could not have been put here to like, be so consumed by a passion for something and for all of these things to happen just for it to be some kind of joke that God is trying to play. It can't be that it is a mistake, right? So even when I'm unsure, there's a poem that I wrote where I say, I'm walking even when darkness falls. I am standing in the light of the everlasting, because it's like, even when I don't know where I'm going, I'm just like putting one foot in front of the other and hoping that something will catch me, which makes me reckless. But also, it hasn't failed me yet.
Yeah, it's working. You
know? So it's, I'm just saying that it is not easy, and what you're experiencing or feeling is part of that unsureness, that like, is it going to work? I don't know. Is all of it is valid, and all of it is, and you're not doing anything wrong by feeling that way. I think you just have to like kind of that's why I said, like, what are you dreaming? What are your hopes and dreams? And the older I get, I feel like the more simple those dreams become, that my work has value in the world, that it helps and supports people, that my family can live off the fruit of my labor, and that I have peace, like alafia, like I have peace in my life. That's, my dreams are not complicated. I'm always saying my dreams are not complicated. So if they are simple, then they can't be that far out there that I can't have them.
Yeah.
I had a question. Actually, before I say my question, I just want to say, and I feel like I said this to the girls, I sent a message to them. I feel like, I don't feel like, you speak like such a writer, like such a poet. Like, it's so interesting to hear you talk. Like, I don't know if anybody has ever said that before, but it's like, I feel like when you talk, I feel like it's almost like you're reciting a poem or like, you know, just a story. It's like so easy to follow along. And I really enjoy just listening to you talk. But back to my question. The show that you had in Nigeria, I think it was Open. Actually, I don't think, I know. I said I think this is out cool, but I know. I went for the show, but anyways, the show opened that you had Nigeria, I think it was about 4 years ago. I guess guess, like, I just have a question about, like, that show. Like, what inspired you to do that? And, like, also in Nigeria? And also, like, just what was the, like, process behind, like, I mean, like, not the technical process, but long story short, like, what was the inspiration behind that open show? Because I thought, like, it was, like, that was one of the first, I think, poetry shows that I've ever been to in Nigeria, and it was just so magical for me, and I really, really enjoyed it. So, like, I guess I was just wondering for you, like, what was the inspiration behind it? Like, why did you choose to do it then and there?
Open. Before Open, I had done a show called Becoming. Mm-hmm. And Becoming was a similar format, but my dreams for Becoming was that it was going to be like the show was at Musan Center, which was full circle for me because I mentioned earlier that my dad used to take me there to watch concerts, and it's like a 350 or 400 seater big show, and so I thought, oh, Becoming will become that sort of thing. And years passed, I didn't do another Becoming, because I felt like I was being called again to do something that felt more intimate and quieter and more honest. Mm-hmm. I wanted to share poems that I wouldn't normally share. I wanted to share poems that were even in progress. I wanted to do it with, like, music. Music is such a big part of my creative process. Like, I write to music, I listen to music, songs inspire poems, etc. I just wanted it to feel like, with Becoming, I was just doing my poems and there was a big band, there was this whole thing. But with Open, I talk in between. I wanted people to understand why I had written certain things and what they meant to me. The show just came to me. Mm. It was like, why don't you try doing something that feels open? Why don't you do, even just the name, just the name. Open.
Like, okay. Yeah.
You know, like, why don't you do something that feels like just inviting people into your process, the way that you think, what you think about when you're writing something, what inspired some of these poems that they may already know. Share new poems, share poems that are imperfect or unfinished, share poems that are thoughts or haiku or mini poems, like, do all of that. So I did the first version that was just in Lagos. It was three locations in Lagos, and it was so well received that I'm like, something is happening. Like, in performance, I have this moment where I feel like my friend Wana has an album called Transcendence, and it's like, there are moments in performance where I feel like something spiritual is happening, and like I've transcended the physical plane. Like, I travel into my mind and my body. I feel the audience is with me in such a way that if a pin were to drop, like, we would hear it. Like, everybody's so, like, other performers will tell you this thing as well. Like, you start off, there's noise, and then slowly it gets quieter and quieter and quieter until everybody's just listening to you.
Yeah.
Which is such, like, a privilege and an honor, really, for people to just stop what they're doing and hear what you're saying. And Open felt like that over and over again. Like, I'm like, something is happening. Like, people would come to the Open show and weep. Wow. Even me, I'm crying. You know, like, it was just like, it felt raw and open, and I knew something was happening. So I did the first three shows in Lagos, and then I had my son. And then when he was 4 months old, I went on tour. I did Edmonton, Calgary, here in Canada. And then I did London, I did Johannesburg, Abuja, and Lagos again, which was, I mean, I can talk about that forever, but it was extremely challenging with a newborn, but we did it, we survived it. And by the Lagos show, we had 300 people in the audience, but, like, trying to make that intimate feeling intimate for 300 people.
Yeah, it's harder. Yeah.
But yeah, that show is, like, Open is still a thing that's going to continue once the world feels a little bit more normal. But I guess it's my more way open. Of doing work that just feels, more doing work that feels close to my heart, that allows people to know me and my work. Like, in my work, I appear to be quite vulnerable and open, but in real life, like, because I do so much of it in my work, I'm kind of like, I have a very small circle, you know, like, I'm not a very public figure. And so Open allows me to, and I'm also shyer than I appear to be, or more introverted, I would say. So Open allows me to, like, kind of be out and open, and then, like, retreat back if I need to. It's my way of being, like,
of giving,
more vulnerable, of giving. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've heard a lot of art, like, people that create do things like that. They speak through their art. That's pretty much their way of giving themselves to the world at that point in time. And then, like, I would imagine a Kendrick Lamar is like that, because he's also not a public figure. But, like, when I listen, I'm a Kendrick fan, if you haven't gotten that yet. But when you listen to his rap, I feel like it's also the same thing. Like, it sounds like he has introspected and he's just giving you the results of his of what he has thought exactly what he's thought about.
It's an interesting thing, and I wanted to respond to that a little bit. I've realized, like, in the last year I've been like in therapy and just like really really thinking about how my mind, like how I work, how my mind works. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people went into therapy during the pandemic because
holla.
But what's come out of that is me realizing that I had, like, I use my work as an escape, right? So I'm able to say things in my poetry and my performance that I wouldn't necessarily say in real life.
Yes.
I also have this thing where I'm being vulnerable, but I'm being vulnerable after I have thought the thing, I've introspected.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Are you me?
And is that really vulnerable, right? Like, is it really vulnerable to only share the story on the other end of it?
I think it still is. It's just your way, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So my way has been that. It's been like, I've gone through the thing. These are the lessons. It's always the lessons, right? But I guess where I'm trying to be is another kind of vulnerability that allows for imperfection. You know, that allows for the messiness of it all. And that happens a bit in Open, which is why I think I'm so fond of that show.
Yeah.
But I found that, like, I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and that makes it difficult to be truly vulnerable in the way that you need to be. And so I'm trying to make my work balance my life, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Imama, had you gone for Open before you heard Swim?
Yes, it came out for Open.
Yeah. Is that what sold you on it?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. Like, I wanted to get that. Like, I think whatever you connected with the crowd, I feel like Imama is a good testament.
Oh yeah, I definitely felt that. Like, it was a magical moment for me. Like, I remember literally living, like, I left Open and I had called on my friend who was meant to come, but she couldn't come. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, literally, the best thing ever. It was the one in Lagos. I think it was, Ozumbam Badiway Avenue. I'm not really sure. I think it was like somewhere in VI, Aisha. It was somewhere in VI. And it was in Lagos. I can't remember the exact place.
It was in VI and it was in Lagos.
I mean, you know, okay, it was in VI.
We're the worst.
In Lagos. But I haven't, I don't know. I don't know the island.
No, I think I know the one. Was it upstairs? Was it at 16 by 16? Or was it at...
Not the silence.
Question. It was
Was it a big venue or a small venue?
It was a smaller venue.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it was a smaller venue. And I think there was... It was like one second. You know, I could probably find the address because I still have the like tickets or something.
I'm just trying to remember because I did two versions of Open. There was one that I did that was like three locations in Lagos, and then there was the tour. I'm trying to figure out if you came to the one that was part of the tour or the other one. Either way, both shows were very similar. I would say one was more recent, and so like I'd had my son by then, so things were like, the poems were more evolved and different.
Yes.
But both of them are still like super special to me, and like that show is magical. Nobody can tell me different. Like, after every Open show, like, there was like a crying festival of like people coming and just like revealing things of themselves to me that poems had inspired, or people just saying, I can't talk about it right now, but like, I'm feeling a way. And I feel like, it wasn't church by any means. Like, I'm not a preacher, but I know that like there was like the spirit was in the room and all of us were like communing with our feelings and our thoughts and our beings. And like, it is such a gift for me to know that the work that I do has the capacity. I mean, it doesn't always happen, but that it has the capacity to do that. Because I also had shows in which I'm like, oh yeah, this was a dud. Like, nothing happened. And that's when I know that the show, like, even if I performed perfectly, I know that like, if I didn't connect in that way, I know that like something, either I wasn't in the room, which means that maybe my mind is elsewhere, or like, I don't know. But whenever I have those feelings of like something spiritual is happening, I know, aha, I was there. Like, I was in the room that day. Those are the kind of shows that I look forward to.
Have you guys seen Soul?
I have. My son loves that show. And it's such adult content, but won't stop watching
it. I cried at the end. But I feel like a lot of the spiritualness of, like, you know, the creativity. Because, you know, in the movie, when he played jazz, apparently they went into like this dimension almost that's like in between here and, like, you know, the spiritual realm and stuff. I know that movie, I know it's an animation, but top tier, 100%.
Yeah, no,
but
I
feel
it.
Like, it's kind of a little bit what you're describing to me. But yeah, talking about your work, I thought it'd be nice to talk about your most recent work from 2019. This is How We Disappear. I got a copy. I'm yet to read it. But could you tell us like what inspired that? And I think you've already talked about your creative process, but for this specific body of work, what were you thinking?
This is How We Disappear is like a very different kind of work. Like, I know people who followed me through the open, through the swim, who have said like this felt like a departure, like it felt like a different side of what you do, and that's great. Like, for me, my hope is for the work to be as
diverse,
expansive as possible. Like, I want to do all the things. But This Is How We Disappear came from reflections on the disappearance of the Chibok girls at the time. Mm. That's where like the first poems came from.
Exactly.
And I started to reflect on global disappearances, how women disappear in so many different ways, and write from those perspectives. Some of them are lived experiences, some of them are stories, some of them are like, you know, it's sort of just like trying to encompass this feeling of the ways that we disappear, but also the ways that we survive that disappearance, mm-hmm. the way that we reemerge as something whole, something new, the ways that we like disappear ourselves from the places that harm us and come back as something else. So it was just me exploring that. Writing for the page is a completely different thing. There are versions of the poem that exist on the page in the book that have live performed versions as well. The way a poem reads on the page feels sometimes quite different from the way that it sounds when I say it out loud.
Yeah.
So I was grateful for the opportunity to work with like a really fabulous editor, Alessandra Nakarato, who helped me through the book, and a publisher who was willing to... an indie publisher, which is a whole other thing, but smaller publisher, but publisher that has a lot of grit and was interested in my work. And it felt important for me to document that time in history, something that really struck me around like what it means for girls to disappear and for nobody to really do anything about it or really seem to care, except for like a small group of very persistent voices and bless them. So that was the inspiration for that book. And also just me like exploring another muscle and writing for another medium.
Yeah.
And trying to do that with the same, you know, with the same ginger.
Why would you say that people think it's a divergent from like
it's just a different, it feels like a different voice. Like it feels like a different me. Yeah. So if you go into it with the expectation of hearing or reading poems from open,
yeah,
then you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
You know, like if you go into it with the expectations of swim, then it's not going to feel the same. But I think when people understand the context of the poems and why they were written and how they were written, then it allows them to like experience
relate
it in
regardless.
The way that it was intended.
Yeah.
It's not a coffee table book. It gets quite dark. It's a hard book at times.
Yeah.
But it was necessary and reflective of where I was in that time.
So yeah, you guys should check it out. I'm yet to read it. I got it just recently and I read the first poem and I knew where it was going. So I was like, no, I have to sit down and read this one. I already could tell.
Ones.
Yeah, those ones that you're like, yeah, this is not a casual read at all. So I look forward to that. Do you guys have any more questions? Because I had a final one before.
Oh, you can go ahead.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I guess... the question is kind of different. I had it before we started this conversation, but I'd say, what do you think what advice would you give anyone that's like at a place where, you know, they have to make a career shift? But they're in between making those decisions and stuff like that, because that was a difficult, like almost a U-turn, because at least sometimes people hop onto careers that are, you know, related at least.
Yeah.
But this was a huge jump. But what advice would you give them? And the reason I say it might be a little different is because I feel like the way you've described it for you, it was like almost like a spiritual direction. It was a natural flow. But I'd still love to hear your response to that, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, to give practical advice.
Yeah.
Because everything cannot exist in the realm of the spiritual, right?
Yeah.
There's like real life consequences to blowing up your life or trying to. I would say it has to be a bit of both, right? So you plan and you pray. So with the planning, it's thinking about what you want to do and why you want to do it and how that serves your purpose, whatever that purpose might be. And some people have many, like, some, I know, have friends who are good at so many different things that it's hard to say, this is the thing I'm supposed to go and do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I think the early years are a time for exploration. Try many things and fail with great enthusiasm. Yeah. You know, like, try many things. It is so hard, though. It is very hard. But what it will do is help you come closer to that thing, the thing. It gives your mind a chance to know itself. Like,
yeah,
to know, like, what it feels to not be, like, to fail at something and how painful that is, but also to say, okay, we try again. Of course, it's easier to do that when the stakes are lower, but sometimes the stakes are already quite high. In that situation, I would say plan. For me, I had saved to give myself this gift, right? And that savings had a finite timeline in which I'm like, it's going to finish. And in that timeline, I said to myself, do all the things, right? So that meant putting myself out there in ways that were spectacularly terrifying, but necessary. So auditioning for a show that, like, you've never acted before, just be going. Experiment with the things that are terrifying to you. Do them. Do all the things. Give yourself some actionable goals, like some things that help boost the journey along. For me, I know that small wins are very important to get me to the end goal. So if my end goal is I want to do a show called Open that has 300 people in the audience by the finale, I have to break the steps down to, first, I have to write some poems. Well, first, I have to live a little bit and go and, like, have a life that informs something that I can write about. Then I have to write the poems. Then I have to think about who I would collaborate with. Then I have to think about, how can I fund this thing? Is this applying for a grant? Is it my own money that I've saved, or some, like, can I get sponsors? Everything that I've done that has been a big, big goal that was terrifying and scary, when I was able to break it down with just one foot in front of the other, that's all I can do every day, is one small thing. I wrote one poem today. Okay, that's one poem towards the 15 poems for Open. Okay, I keep going.
Yeah.
I spoke to somebody today who says they have one venue. I'll go and look at the venue. Like, I was just moving, not because I knew that I was going to be able to pull it off, but I'm like, the only way to get to this end goal is just to do the things that get me there.
Yeah.
Until I'm there. You know, for me personally, and I don't know if this works for other people, it's like, I also need to be accountable to something or someone. So it's either I've told somebody I'm going to, it's like when you want to exercise or whatever it is, like, you either you go with a buddy or you tell them, like, this is what I'm trying to do. For me, I'd made an announcement on the internet.
Not those ones.
On this day, at this time. So, hello.
It had to.
Like, you're going to make it happen.
Yeah.
You know. So giving yourself places to be accountable, people to be accountable to, and also that, like, it's never too late to start a thing. I'm 36 years old and I still feel like I'm at the beginning of my career. I have two children and I still feel like I'm at the beginning of my career. It is, what I'm learning is that you are always brand new. There are always opportunities to redirect the thing. And there's no shame at all in working your job that you are working, that's paying your bills. You know, and in that time when you have that cushion, when you have that support, use that as your exploration time. If there are things that I would do differently, I probably could have extended my time in engineering a bit longer. And that would have made the beginning a little bit less painful. But it happened, right? But I would say that if you have a good thing going that is working for you and you're trying to pivot, you don't rush that pivot. Like, give yourself time within what is existing. Not thinking, oh, I want to do this thing by the time I'm 30. And that's like, you're killing yourself over that. No. What if you do it the year after that? Like, nothing is going to...
You're not rushing anywhere.
You're not rushing it, yeah. Right? So slowly into the pivot. If there are courses you can take, take them. If there are people who are doing the thing that you want to do, learn from them. And people also will be my mentor. Mentorship isn't always like you don't always have to call the person on the phone for them to mentor. You can, the internet is big and free for us to learn in ways that we never used to be able to. Like, you can take master classes on almost anything you can think of. Use that as like a practice into the thing that you're trying to do. Do a sound check in that way. Like I did, I took a leave of absence from the job I was doing to go and put my feet in the water a little bit, go back to my job. The process can be slow and like a slow cook, and that too is valid. And I would say finally, like, there's an element of grace, luck, serendipity that goes into all of this planning and praying. It's like sometimes it's also being able to recognize when a moment presents itself and rising to that occasion. Okay, I've been invited to do XYZ, to give a talk, to teach a workshop, to speak in, like, all of these sorts of things, or even smaller things. Like, I've been invited to a brunch in which somebody I have looked up to or like really is going to be there. Okay, I'm going to rise to the occasion. Like, I'm going to show up, and I'm going to show up prepared to like ask questions or prepared, you know, like those sorts of things. So recognizing when a moment is there and getting out of the way. Because there's a lot of self-sabotage as well. There's a lot of like, oh, like ways in which we kind of like
that part.
Tell me about it.
Before it's even happened. So it's always just like, I've done my work. I know this thing and I'm walking. So many of the biggest moments that I've had, I've been moments in which I was terrified that I was going to disgrace everybody I know. But the risk of disgrace is always there. And it's like, I have, you know, I'm not on TikTok, but there's a video that goes around of people cringing when they remember certain things that they've done.
Yeah.
I remember when.
I have, there's a particular moment, and I won't say it out loud so that only me will know, that I think about all, I'm 36, this thing happened years ago. I still think about it, where I'm just like, you know, it was so embarrassing, but it happened and nobody died, you know?
I don't know. So, I feel like people can actually die from embarrassment. I feel like I can die from embarrassment.
No, if Eva actually moves like she can die from embarrassment.
Oh God. Honestly, I'm very, very scared of embarrassment. I mean, I'm cannot even
thinking
lie.
About it right now. Maybe I can die from it. I don't know. There are some things that will stick with you forever. And if that is the price to pay, like if the price to pay is some of those moments along the way, some small disgrace, is it like you ask yourself, is it okay? Can I live through it? And if the answer is yes, then we move. And sorry for anybody that remembers that. I wasn't there. Who, when, when? How? It could not have been me. It must have been another person with my name and face. So there will be moments of falling flat on your face. And there's this, I can't remember the quote, Brene Brown.
Oh my gosh.
And it's about like, if you're not in the arena, getting dirty, getting disgraced, getting bruised up, then you can't, like, there's nothing to be said. But like, honor goes to the people who step into the arena and are ready for the fight that is required to live this wild and wonderful life. Like, that is where the action is happening. So it's easy to sit on the sidelines and criticize and say, I could have done it. They could have done it this way or whatever. Do your own. Let your own be bad first. Then do it 10 more times.
If easy. Yeah.
You know, do it if easy. Exactly. And the only way that these things get better is like just by doing. Like I have my family is always saying how I never tell them when I have a show. I never tell them when I have a book. My parents have never read, like, because I'm always just doing the thing. And it's because a part of me is like, still very shy about these things. I always think my last work was the worst thing I ever did, and everything in front is better. And that's also, like, my toxic traits. but I think that it is, like, it's about allowing yourself to be vulnerable. And Brene always says, be awkward, brave, and kind. And it's that's the thing. It's like, let it be clumsy and foolish, but you're courageous and brave in the doing of it. And you do it with grace. Like, I feel like that's all you can really ask for.
Yeah.
But grace to yourself.
That you have a dream or a calling or a pivot that you're called to do, and you don't do it, time is still going to pass anyway.
Yeah.
Like, time is still going
to go.
Actually,
the 5 years are going to go anyways.
Anyway. And one thing I know to be true is that, like, if you have a dream or a calling that has said to you, go and do, and you don't do, you're still going to do it, but it never gets easier.
Yeah.
You know, like, and the lesson returns over and over again, and God will blow up your life until you do this.
until you
go ahead and do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's been my experience anyway. So just be brave. I know that it's hard. I know that all of it feels very high stakes, but some of the moments that I thought were going to destroy everything, I look back now and I just chuckle, and that's life.
Yeah.
Wow.
Thank you. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, wow.
That was something.
Thank you so
much. It's been amazing.
Wait. Before we go, I remember where it was.
Where what was? Oh, you got the ticket?
I had to look through my email, but it was the open tour finale in Lagos.
Was a tour.
Yes, it was a finale, and that was, which is beautiful. But yeah, so that was it. Sorry, you can go ahead, Matilda, proceed.
Yeah, okay. I was just gonna say thank you so much. This was, I feel like, a timely conversation, and I feel like anyone listening, I feel like there's, you always need to be reminded of these things, to be very honest, because sometimes we just go with the flow in life, and it's a nice reminder. Thank you so much.
It's a reminder for me also, I must say, but thank you
for sharing your stories with us. They were really, really awesome.
Honestly,
very heartwarming.
Yeah.
You say you're not vulnerable, but I feel like you might be our most vulnerable guest.
Yeah, like, you were just so open. Like, you know, the things that you shared were just like, she's very open.
So we really appreciate that. And you should also definitely check this out when it comes out too, because it might, I find even on this podcast, sometimes I hear myself back and I'm like, I don't follow my own advice. So
I need to go listen back to some episodes, because
maybe you're not listening to yourself.
I'm not listening to myself, for real.
Yeah. So thank you so much. So much.
Thank you so much.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's really, really been quite an episode. And don't forget to follow us on all our socials at AfricaLipsoPod. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We are on YouTube now, so you should check us out there, the AfricaLipso
Podcast. Like, share, subscribe.
Yeah, but catch you guys next week. Bye.
Bye.
For sure, musicians. Wow.